Hello and welcome to an Inside College Hockey podcast for Wednesday, January 17th. That is the date this is recorded, but not the date you're listening to it. Thanks for tuning in, as always, and for downloading us on iTunes, if you have done that. I'm Joe Gladyszewski, ECAC Hockey League writer and host of the podcast, joined by Inch co-editor Mike Eidelbist, Hockey East writer Jeff Howe, and as always, from Invergrove Heights, Minnesota, a sophomore, number 29, Jess Myers.
Wow, I'm in the starting lineup. That's the first time ever, I think.
There you go. A sophomore goaler.
That's right, sophomore goaler. Lefty, rare lefty goalie. Anyway.
Catch left or shoot left?
Well, I don't shoot a lot playing goalie, but whatever.
John Quick does.
Yes.
Nice.
John Quick does.
And
well,
the perfect
place to start. Welcome back, Rook. He's back on the podcast this week, and we are going to start with a little Hockey East discussion and a statement weekend by the Boston University Terriers, who won two games at Maine's Alphond Arena. And we'd been kind of waiting for BU to go in one direction, whether that was forward or backward, as they were treading water with a lot of ties and a okay record and some okay results. But they showed a lot to me last weekend with those two wins, Jeff.
Yeah, I mean, that was huge. And not only, I mean, not just the two wins, but the way they did it by scoring nine goals last weekend. Because, I mean, their biggest problem was scoring. I mean, I know they've kind of picked it up of late, but then had that scoreless shutout. The scoreless tie about a week and a half ago. But then came out and scored six the first night and scored three the second night. And when they've got John Curry behind them playing as well as he has all season, then, if they come out and they can score three, four goals a game, then they're gonna start winning a whole lot more often than they tie, which is a good thing around BU these days.
That's a good thing around every campus.
And no kidding.
That's true.
Boss, we were doing the power rankings and looking at some of BU's stuff, and the comment I made was their stats are still even a little bit depressing. But they've seemed to make it through by getting contributions from a lot of different players. Is that what you've seen, Jeff?
Yes and no. I mean, when the goals are down, it's hard to say that they're getting contributions from a lot of different players because, you know, a lot of different players aren't exactly contributing. But, I talked to Pete MacArthur the other day, and he was just saying how BU's system is really tough to learn. And, I mean, for whatever reason, they're a notoriously slow starting team, or at least have been the last couple of years. So, it didn't help that Brandon Yip was hurt through, the entire first half, but he came back and he's going to spark their offense a whole lot more, give them two legitimate scoring lines. And MacArthur bounced back with his first career hat trick on Friday night. So if he can get things going, he's on a similar pace that he was on last season. So if he, jumps out and has a strong second half, then good things could happen for this team. But, like I said earlier, John Curry's playing the best hockey of his career. We seem to say that every single year about him. So, just to see him continue to improve in this defense, playing unbelievable hockey, all they need to do is, find that puck lock that they've been missing through the first half, and they could put a serious charge into the top half of Hockey East.
Yeah.
Go ahead. I was going
to
say.
I'm going to send it right back to you, Bus, but the point being about BU scoring is Pete MacArthur is their leading scorer. He's got less than a point a game and only nine goals. They don't have a single 10-goal scorer on their team, and they've played 20 games.
Yeah, that is a little bit depressing when you look at it from that regard. But, it's been a while since we've looked at BU and thought of them as a real high-powered offensive team. They've kind of started with their goaltending and moved their way forward. And obviously, Yip coming back is huge for them because they need that balance, I think, because they're not going to have the one or two guys that really carry that offense. But, I think that the most interesting thing about that team is obviously Curry, and just he continues to get better and better and better. And, this is a kid that literally came out of nowhere. I mean, he more or less showed up on campus and didn't have a scholarship, and I barely had a spot on the team. And now, you can argue that he's the most valuable player in that conference. I you know, with the exception of maybe Trevor Smith, who is more important to their team than Curry? He has evolved into that type of player.
I agree completely. And, you know, Curry in one way, I mean, in that regard, Curry is the most valuable player in Hockey East this season to date, because BU has been able to come out of so many games with 1 point, because even though they're scoring one goal, two goals, one goal, one goal, one goal, two goals. I mean, it was a scary-looking pattern for a while there. But, I mean, if Trevor Smith disappears from UNH, they still got, you know, five kids who are probably going to score at least 25 to 30 points this season. So, I mean, yeah, Trevor Smith's having an amazing, amazing year. I've talked highly of him all season, but Curry is definitely more valuable to the Terriers than Smith is to the Wildcats.
You know, I want to, and I haven't seen Curry play in person. I've seen him on TV a number of times, and in the Hobie Tracker this week, we mentioned him as our bull market guy, as a guy whose stock is going up. And I referred to him as kind of the Rocky Balboa of college hockey. You know, this guy just keeps throwing himself in front of pucks, and, you know, faces every shot, and you just can't knock him down. I mean, he takes everything that comes his way and deals with it. And, you know, at the end, he's right there with the numbers and with the statistics and keeping his team in games. And I think that, you know, we always talk about the people who are, you know, maybe the most underrated or the most unsung or something like that. But I think he really is the most underrated, the most unsung player in the nation. I don't think anybody can argue with that.
No, and I mean, I think a good part of that has to do with the fact that, you know, he's not even the most well-known goalie in Boston, because, you know, Corey Schneider gets so much publicity because he's the draft pick. He could have gone pro at, you know, last summer, and he had that huge shutout streak last year. But, you know, Curry has just always kind of been in the back burner of Schneider. But, you know, as over the last, I'd say, season and a half of hockey, I mean, since Schneider had that huge shutout streak going, he's kind of cooled off a bit. And, I mean, he's still been very good, but he has a game here and there when, you know, he'll give up five or six goals, but you just never, ever see that from John Curry. Well, you know, save for the five-goal performance he allowed BC to have in last year's regional. But, you know, he's very, very consistent and very steady in the net.
His save percentage is .929. Which is exactly equal to the save percentage that RIT's Jocelyn Guimond has, another guy who was mentioned in the Hobie Tracker this week as a hidden Hobie. Jess Myers, we'll bring you into the conversation if you're still there, and I know you don't have the national stats in front of you, so I'm going to throw this out there. Where do you think they rank nationally in save percentage among Division I goalies at .929?
You want me to just venture a guess on that one?
Yeah, tied for like.
First of all, let me say a big thank you for bringing me into the conversation with questions about RIT to explore.
You're our goaltending coach at DH headquarters, Jess.
I'm going to venture a guess.
Goalie perspective. Tied
and,
for what?
I would say he is tied for fourth nationally.
Those two guys tied for fourth?
Yeah. How'd I do?
Brooke, you got a guess on that? Do you know?
I'll go with ninth.
Ninth, exactly. Tied for ninth.
Man.
That means there's
that
eight goalies, yeah. Eight goalies in the country are .930 or better. That's amazing to me.
That's ridiculous.
I mean, Ryan Miller's got to be sour on that. You were close to that season that Millsy had, Bus. What were his numbers, do you remember?
Oh, boy.
Approximately?
He was, I want to say he was about .948.
.948, wow.
That's ridiculous. That's just...
Yes, it is.
Gets to the point. And I think, who's the... I don't have the numbers right in front of me. I'm trying to think, is the kid from Brown still on top? I mean, he's something like .956.
Let me look.
Can't remember if it's...
As it stands, at the time of this podcast recording, the leader in save percentage is Lake Superior State's Jeff Jakaitis. At 943. Dan Rosen of Brown is 941. Kellen Briggs of your Minnesota Golden Gophers is 934. And then three guys tied at 932, those being John Quick of the University of Massachusetts Amherst Minutemen, David Leggio of Clarkson, and Peter Menino of the Denver Pioneers.
Wow.
Menino's teammate Glenn Fisher comes in at 931, and then Vermont's Joe Fallon checks in at 930, and then Guimond and Curry, along with Kevin Reagan, are tied for ninth. So
some pretty good goaltending out there in Hockey East.
Pretty good goaltending out there in college hockey.
Yeah, either that or they're wearing giant pads, one of the two. I don't know.
Bad shooters.
There you go. Could be that, too. Composite sticks. That's what it is.
Speaking on behalf of untalented goalies, the big pads don't help.
Speaking
what if
of untalented...
What if you had a sumo wrestler and put him on skates?
We should have invited good friend Dave McNabbin on this conversation.
Wow.
Wow.
We should have an entire mediocre goalie show sometime.
You going to host that, Chess?
Special guest Dave McNabbin, Matty Kaltiainen.
What about Neil Koepke?
Well, Koepke is a mediocre goaltender, but a fantastic ambassador of the game of hockey.
Ambassador. He's a regular, yeah. He's a Madeline Albright.
Wow.
I don't know.
Segue out of that one, champ.
Okay, I will. Neil's envious of Madeline Albright's hair? I don't know.
Man. Wow.
Jess, let's stay on the mediocre goaltending discussion and talk about the Minnesota Golden Gophers, because that's been the kind of punchline or the knock on that team. But, you know, you look at Briggs' season, it's been spectacular, and then Frazee comes back from World Junior, and he looks like a changed performer. I think they're pretty set in goal.
The one comment I've gotten from friends of mine at the University of Minnesota in the last 2 months, at least about our podcast, is we had a pretty notable anti-Jeff Frazee rant, especially right after the College Hockey Showcase, when he – you know, just flat out did not play very well against Michigan State. And his coach said as much after the game, saying, you know, we won the game for our goalie tonight. Since that time, Frazee, as you say, has looked like a changed person. I mean, he went over to Sweden. He sat the bench the first two games. Coach Ron Rolson did not play him either of Team USA's first two games, both of which were losses. Then all of a sudden put Frazee in the lineup, and they wind up with a bronze medal. And if you watch those games, he played outstanding, and then he comes back to the WCHA and shuts out Wisconsin in his first game. Now, you say, hey, shut out Wisconsin. Who hasn't this year? But, you know, that's an easy joke, the way the Badgers have lacked scoring. But, no, he, you know, all of a sudden Minnesota has, you know, arguably one of the two strongest goaltending tandems in the WCHA, the other one being at Denver. You know, we mentioned the stats of those guys. Menino and Fisher, and interestingly enough, those four goalies will be on display facing one another this weekend at Mariucci Arena.
Yeah, let's talk about that series a little bit. Denver have a shot, do you think?
You know, if I were Denver, I would, you know, talk your guys into, hey, we can go in there and split. I realistically don't think, you know, anyone's going to beat Minnesota twice at home right now. They're just too solid top to bottom. They're still playing great hockey. Yeah, they lost a game, but keep in mind, it's the first game they've lost since October. And what really impressed me about Minnesota last weekend, if you watch the games against Wisconsin, was the grit that that team showed. I mean, we all knew that they, you know, had decent goaltending and they had tons of scoring, but to gut out a 1-0 win a night after a 2-1 loss, I mean, you really saw that that team has some fortitude and is looking more and more like the complete package as the season wears on here.
I'm going to talk a little bit about Wisconsin and what they accomplished with that split against Minnesota. You know, again, they might, with the way their season's gone so far, go into that weekend with, you know, the mindset that a split is good. And there were some pretty pointed comments in both the Cap Times and the State Journal, the two major newspapers in Madison, about that. Maybe lack of intensity or complacency that the Badgers showed on Saturday's game after they had won on Friday night. they came out flat, and the players admitted that, and the coach admitted that, and it was good for me to see that there was some unhappiness there, because a lot of teams, you know, there are a lot of teams in the country that would make their season. You know, we're not going to the NCAA tournament. We're probably not going to make a big run in our conference tournament. And I'm not saying that's the case for Wisconsin, because I think they can still get there. But the fact that they're unsettled, I mean, that's a championship attitude right there, that they want to go out and they want to win every game, even though where they are right now, a split against Minnesota looks pretty good.
Well, they don't have, you know, any excuses anymore, I would say. If you're the Badgers, you're healthy now. You've survived that horrendous stretch they had in November where it just seemed like they couldn't buy a goal and couldn't buy a win. They've shown some life. They've worked their way back up into, you know, contention for the top half of the league standings. So there are no more excuses to be had. I mean, if you go out there and stink up a game, that's exactly what it is. You're stinking up a game. It's not, boy, we're banged up. We haven't found our legs yet. We're still adjusting. All of that's gone. Now it's time to see what the Badgers are made of. And like you, I was kind of refreshed to see that attitude and say, hey, you know, we've got some stuff to prove.
You think
Let's turn it over to CCHA land a little bit, Bus.
Yeah.
Talk about this weekend. Two series maybe aren't at the tippy top of the standings, but will make a big difference in determining those top four spots in the regular season and who gets a bye in that first round of the playoffs. You've got Michigan State and Lake Superior State battling, as well as Miami and Ohio State.
Yeah, they're really two interesting series and kind of a study of to a certain extent of teams that are kind of going in opposite directions. Michigan State has really played well over the last 4 or 5 weeks. I think they've won something like 7 of their last 8, and now they get a Lake State team that's coming into Munn on the heels of a couple losses to Notre Dame up in Sault Ste. Marie, and you know, a lot of similarities, I think, to you know, what happened in Wisconsin, where the Badgers came out with a lot of emotion on Friday and then were kind of flat Saturday. The only difference being Lake State didn't get a win on Friday. They played lost in overtime to Notre Dame, and then Notre Dame came out and beat them pretty easily.
4-1, wasn't it?
4-1 on Saturday night. So, yeah. And then Michigan State, you know, the interesting thing about their, you know, their recent streak where they've gone 7-1 or something to that extent in their last 8 is only 3 of those games have been at home. So, you know, they're getting some confidence, and now they get to play in their own building, you know, a little bit more here over the second half of the season. And, you know, this will be a big series as far as that positioning. I think that, you know, Michigan State is starting to make its statement now and kind of playing the way we thought they'd play all season long. Then you look at maybe a little bit more of kind of teams, not necessarily heading in opposite directions, but, you know, Miami, they've got a home-and-home this weekend with Ohio State, and actually the Sunday game is the ESPNU game this week. They're undefeated in their last 5, and it's actually a streak that started at the Ohio Hockey Classic over the holidays, where they beat Miami in the championship game. And Miami, since that loss, has played 500 hockey. They're 3-3, I think, or 3-4, right around there. And, you know, they've kind of been there the way they've been all season. They play really well on Friday, not so good on Saturday. So, you know, they've got Miami's got, if you look at kind of their the way they've played over the last couple weeks, last few weeks, they've got some question marks, I think. You know, starting with Jeff Zatkoff in his first start back since the World Juniors, did not play real well against Western Michigan. He was they torched him for 5 goals in a 5-2 loss. And you know, Nathan Davis, who's been our Hobie Tracker number one guy on the big board for a few weeks now, did not have a good series either, so I think he was -6 on the weekend. So, you know, you got to wonder a little bit what's going on with Miami and why all of a sudden they're inconsistent.
Yeah, I wanted to talk about the Hobie Track a little bit, and we'll close the podcast with that. But one of the notable situations in the CCHA last weekend was a post-game fight between some players on Alaska and Michigan State that took place in Mount Ice Arena, apparently set off by some heated words between two coaches, pardon me, and if two coaches were to instigate a fight between teams last weekend, I would have thought for certain it would have been George Roll and Mike Schaefer in the Clarkson-Cornell game on Saturday night after the intense series that those two teams have had in the last three playoff seasons as well as regular seasons. Different styles of play, different attitudes, and, you know, whenever they get together, it's usually a very spirited contest. I attended their game Saturday night. It was a 1-1 tie that lacked really a lot of action points. It was kind of a boring game, as one might say, but both teams got out of there with a point. Clarkson now has the longest unbeaten streak in the country, despite not winning last week. And I think they're in a good spot, but St. Lawrence really showed a lot of people that they're for real. With two wins, they beat Cornell and Colgate last week. So there will be more on the Clarkson-Cornell series and the extended history they've had. These seniors, according to Bob Alfeld at Clarkson Radio, have played 14 games against each other over the last 3.5 years. And they play again in the regular season next week. That's astonishing to play a team that much.
Yeah, that's a lot of games. You know, and I think, and I'm going off of memory here, I think that this Sunday's game, when Miami plays Ohio State, that will be the 20th game for the seniors on those two teams against each other.
Wow.
That's, yeah. And that's just, I mean, that's downright ridiculous. 20 games.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, that's right. They're scheduling clusters in the CCHA.
Guaranteed 4 games a year. And then the Ohio Hockey Classic.
And playoffs.
Plus, you know, CCHA playoffs. And so, yeah, they'll play for, I think, number 19 and 20 this weekend. That's...
Wow, yeah. So that kind of renders my point a little useless.
No, but still, I mean, think about it. In the context of that league where you only see a team twice a year.
Yeah.
Playing 14 times that means you're running into the same cats a lot.
Yeah.
Mike, let me ask you a quick CCHA question as long as we're still talking. I don't know if you guys saw the game summary. I didn't see any of the game, obviously, but on Tuesday night, Minnesota State and Nebraska-Omaha played. You know, they get together a couple times a year, the Battle of the Mavericks. This one happened to be in Omaha. Minnesota State won it in overtime. What struck me about it, and yes, it was a non-conference game on a Tuesday night, but the attendance at the Quest Center in Omaha, which I think seats like 12,000 or something like that, the announced attendance, paid attendance, was 2,700. Now, I remember a time not so long ago when you could not get a ticket for hockey in Omaha. It was the hottest thing happening. We talked a little bit over the summer about, you know, talk about stuff going on in the booster club and, you know, the coach being unpopular and whatever, but is this Omaha program in trouble? Is that a sign or was it a fluke?
I don't think it's a sign so much as it is. It's been 10, 11 years now for that program, and, you know, some of the luster obviously is worn off, and, you know, I don't think that, you know, they got out of the gates, you know, in their first season with, you know, on pretty good footing. I remember them beating Denver a couple of times for their first and second wins, and they were playing a real competitive hockey right away. And really, you know, I think that there is an expectation, not just in Omaha, but also nationally, that, you know, this program would keep building and building and building. Well, it's built kind of, and last year they qualified for the NCAA tournament or were invited to the NCAA tournament, their first ever bid. But I don't think that they've reached the heights that, you know, most people expected that program could achieve. I think that they've plateaued a little bit, and you know, this is just an outsider's perspective. But you know, they've had some real good individual players, but never really, as a team, been able to make a strong run at a CCHA title or, you know, a run through the CCHA tournament other than the 1 year, I think, back in 2000 when they beat Michigan in the semis of the CCHA tournament, but ended up losing in the championship game. So
that was like their first or second year in the league, wasn't
yeah,
it? Right?
Yeah, it was 2000.
Yeah.
I remember our friend Paul Shaheen telling us about, you know, heading up to that CCHA tournament, being on a freeway in Chicago and seeing this stream of cars heading toward Detroit, all with, you know, UNO flags and banners. And, I mean, there was some genuine excitement about that program at the time. I guess it just struck me as surprising to see that small a crowd, even if it is a non-conference game.
Well, yeah, you know, it's a non-conference game on Tuesday night, and I have no idea what the weather was like over there on Tuesday. There might have been more ice on the roads than there was in the rink. But
keep in mind, paid attendance at 2,700, does that mean you have less than 2,700 season ticket holders? I mean, wow, that's
not surprising, Jess. Don't... Most rings in my league don't seat 2,700.
You know,
I guess it surprises me from...
The other thing that you've got to figure into this is, and I've not looked at comparable data, but Omaha now has an American Hockey League affiliate.
Yep.
And playing in the old bullpen there where the Mavs used to play.
No way.
Yeah, believe it or not, they still have...
Come on.
They've got... Yeah.
Really? I didn't know that.
The Knights play in the, I think it's called the Civic Auditorium.
Yep.
Which is a really cool old building. I mean,
something like 8,700 seats or something
yeah,
like that?
Yeah, it's right around 8,000. It's, you know, it's
wow,
great.
I didn't realize
it was
that.
The old barn. But, you know, obviously that's got a dent attendance. And, of course, you know, the other thing, it's, you know, Omaha has...
Students are away, probably.
Has a very... Yeah, students could potentially be away. I don't know what their schedule is, but... You know, and Omaha's like, you know, it's a good USHL town, too,
yeah.
With the Lancers. No, Omaha's a good sports town. There's no question about it. And I don't see it as a bandwagon town, but, you know, I think at some point in time, you know, you can't be content. You know, are you asking fans to be content with a program that's 2-3 games above 500 every year? Year in and year out.
I remember a couple of years ago in my notebook, I criticized North Dakota for not selling out a Friday night game with Boston College. This was in October. You know, BC was ranked number one. The Sioux were ranked, you know, two or three in the country, and they had 1,000 empty seats for a Friday night game in Grand Forks. I got a bunch of nasty emails back saying that I underestimated the popularity of high school football in eastern North Dakota. So hey, who knows? There may be something big that was going on Omaha on Tuesday night. But.
Yeah. Could have been wrestling or something.
Okay. There you go.
Rook, I want to come back to BU and Maine a little bit and talk about the other side of the equation with the Maine Black Bears.
Yeah.
The record and their start was very impressive, but it seems to me that they've had two real key weekends as far as proving themselves, and both stretches of those games, they've fallen flat. They had a stretch with New Hampshire and Vermont and Boston College that turned out to be their first three losses of the year. And then they had another schedule that was what I would call, you know, less challenging. Some of the teams in the bottom half of the hockey standings and a few non-league games. Then they played BU at home and lost twice again. What do you think that says about the Black Bears?
Well, you know, I saw Maine play a few weeks ago at Lowell, so I got to talk to a few of the guys. And that was one of the things I asked them was about that three-game losing streak and what happened. And, you know, the general consensus was, you know, they just – flat out said that if they don't bring it every night, they're not going to win. So, I mean, I tend to believe that when they lost those first three games, they kind of got a little full of themselves for a bit there. But then they came back and they rebounded. But it's worth noting, even, you know, the weekend before they got swept by BU, they played two with Lowell. And Friday night, that first game, I mean, they won the game, but they were very, very lucky to come out with a win against Lowell. I think it was a 4-2 game. But, I mean, even Tim Whitehead will say they got outplayed and they didn't deserve to win that game. And, you know, came back strong and won that Saturday game. But, I mean, you know, on one hand, the 6-5 win and the 3-0 win, you know, were two impressive wins for BU. But, you know, seeing Maine and Ben Bishop give up 6 goals to a team that, you know, for the most part has been struggling on offense is a bit alarming. So, I mean, Maine is in the category with BC right now in the fact that you think that they should be, you know, one of those teams that can make a run and a real push to the Frozen Four and maybe beyond, but you wonder which team is going to show up on any given night. And, you know, if those two teams I really expected would give BC, I mean, would give UNH a run for, you know, the hockey's regular season crown, but, I mean, UNH is the only team playing real consistent hockey in Hockey East right now. But, yeah, I mean, I was as shocked as anybody in the world about Maine dropping 2 at Alphon to BU last weekend.
You know, one thing that would concern me, and this is just going off the things that I've read about what happened on Saturday, if I was a Maine fan, is, you know, not just getting swept by BU, and, you know, certainly that team has enough talent that they can deal with that and move on. But one thing that would concern me is just is how in that game against BU, how the team just seemed to implode with, you know, taking penalties, and, you know, we've heard about a couple shooting after the whistle infractions, and, you know, whether they were legitimate or not, kind of up for discussion. And I think there was a fighting, and then Coach Whitehead having a discussion with the official after the game, and obviously I think his comments following the game are pretty well publicized, but I think that would concern me more than, you know, getting swept is, you know, is how the team appeared to lose its composure, and you know, maybe it says to me as a Maine fan that, boy, I don't know if this team can deal with adversity. You know, it's going to happen during the course of the year where you're going to face something. You know, and everything's not going to go your way all the time. And, you know, for the way the Maine team reacted in the loss on Saturday it would concern me a little bit, I think.
Well, I mean, there's a couple of notes I would have on that. First of all, I don't know if I've ever met a Hockey East fan who enjoys any of the officials in the league, but Scott Hansen, who was refereeing that game on Saturday night, is, you know, one of the highest rated officials in Hockey East. And, you know, that's coming straight from the mouth of Joe Britannia, who's the commissioner. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, it's a bit strange to, you know, see a team so frustrated with a guy like Scott Hansen. But, I mean, the other point I was going to make is, I mean, out of all 59 teams in college hockey, how many of them go through an entire 30-some-odd game season and don't have a game like that where they just don't, where they feel like the official is just screwing them on every single call? And you know what? Shooting after the whistle is shooting after the whistle. There's nothing that's really, and that's a pretty cut and dry penalty. Those aren't usually called if it's not a shooting after the whistle penalty. I mean, those are pretty serious. That can really, you know, ruin a team's chances to win a game just by taking one of those things. So I find it hard to believe that, and I mean, I didn't see the game, but I find it hard to believe that, you know, those were as poorly called as you hear about. But I mean, some of those Maine diehards are known to, you know, have one-sided views of these games.
Right, and I didn't mean to interrupt.
No, go ahead.
I don't want to crucify Maine or give the wrong impression, but, you know, those penalties like that, and again, I think you're dead on, spot on, that you don't call those penalties unless you're absolutely sure that's what you saw. I mean, if there's any gray area, I think you give the benefit of the doubt to the guy and you don't call it, but I think that, you know, I would be a little bit concerned about the lack of composure and just seeing what seems like a failure to deal with, you know, a little adversity and some tough times. I mean, you know, it's one thing to take, you know, maybe a stupid penalty or, you know, a hook or a slash or a hold, but to shoot after the whistle, that's just really, it's stupid. I mean, is there any excuse for shooting after the whistle? Yeah, a player said that he couldn't hear it, but you know, I don't know. I don't know if that's I don't know if that's a justifiable defense for that for the infraction.
Right. I mean, you know, that's as a that's just one of those types of games that you just have to completely forget about. I mean, every team in every single sport has a game like that in the season. I mean, if they only have one, then they're pretty well off. So, what would concern me is, and I'm almost almost positive Maine plays Providence this weekend. If Maine comes out,
Yes, they do.
That's true. Two at Providence, and then they host Northeastern for two.
Right. I mean, if you know, if and Northeastern's a very tough team. Northeast, but that's a completely different subject for another time. But if Maine, you know, falls flat on its face at Providence this weekend, then I would be concerned. But I wouldn't sound the alarms just because, you know, Maine couldn't deal with the adversity of one night, you know, a bad game against BU. What would concern me more is the fact that they lost a 6-5 game. You know, if you read the box score or just saw the line score and said, oh, you know, they lost 6-5, must have been a wild one. They were down 6-2 with about 8 minutes left. And, you know, if it wasn't for the fact that they put together a little run there, I mean, they completely hid the fact that they got absolutely blown out of the water by BU the first night, and that would concern me more than anything else.
Agreed on that. Let's wrap this podcast with a little Hobie talk. I think that
before we do, Joe, I just want to. You mentioned Joe Bertagno. Rook mentioned Joe Bertagno. I want to invite Joe to our mediocre goalie show too. I don't think it would be complete without Joe included.
That's a good idea.
There you go.
Okay, go ahead.
We'll have to set this up at the Frozen Four. One of our Frozen Four podcasts will be the Mediocre Goalie Show.
Absolutely.
All right.
We'll find the buzzer in.
I'll wear my Jason mask.
I'll wear my Dan Clucci mask.
Oh.
I hate you. Is I hate you, better? Dan Clucci.
Is he getting better? Because I don't think he qualifies as mediocre just yet.
Yeah. Step up.
The Kings got a hell of a break when he went out with an indefinite period of time with a knee injury. Watch the Kings make a run here, kids. Watch it.
I think Mark Crawford inflicted that knee injury.
Mark Crawford had to coach the poor guy for that many years in a row.
He went completely on his knee.
Yeah, he hired Jeff Galooly. We have a game at the Joe coming up. We're set that up.
Okay, Hobie talk. We've had our Hobie tracker going all year, and there's some nice players, some Nathan Davises and David Browns and Teddy Purcells, Michelle Leviers, T.J. Hensicks, any Gophers, you know, you might want to throw in the mix. But
Trevor Smith.
Is it just me, or is this Hobie race kind of lacks some sizzle? You don't have any real runaway candidates that you can get excited about, like a Sertich or a Sterling or a Vanek or, you know, anybody from Hockey East in recent years that really you pay money to go out to the rink and watch on a nightly basis.
Mike maybe Miles. Maybe that's why the goalies' numbers are so good.
That's a good point.
Yeah, there you go. Well, I think that's something we've talked about a little bit, you know, here and there all year is that, you know, the star power, I think, is really down across the nation. And obviously, Jess can talk in great detail about that there is no, you know, there's no Kessel out there, and there isn't a Matt Carl or guys of that nature, you know, guys who really grab somebody's attention. I mean, T.J. Hensick's had a nice year, but he's got 38 points and 7 goals. I mean, is that he's up there in the scoring lead, but to me, a scoring line of 7 goals and 31 assists isn't a Hobie Baker-esque scoring line. I think you're absolutely right. There isn't that. It just isn't really a very sexy race right now.
I will say, if Teddy Purcell up in Maine does stay for a few years, and I have no idea what he's going to do. I can't really speculate on that, but, you know, we know what we know. Good players tend to leave early. But if Teddy Purcell stays until he's a junior or a senior, I absolutely would bet my entire house that he's going to win a Hobey Baker before the end of his college career if he stays 3 or 4 years. That kid, I was so impressed when I saw him play a couple weeks ago. I mean, he's all the hype that he's been getting earlier this season is absolutely worth it. He plays well beyond his years. He's the most dominant player on that main team. He impressed me more than Lelier. And, you know, they play on the same line together. He's a very, very good player. He could be one of college hockey's next great stars if he sticks around.
Ladies, you should write about that.
Ladies and gentlemen.
I think eventually I'll get around to that.
Is that Beano Cook? I think that was Beano Cook talking.
Ron Paulus.
Ron Paulus.
Three Heisman trophies.
Yeah.
Yeah, where's Stanton's?
Whoa.
Drew Stanton is a hero of American athletics.
Hey, I can't talk poorly of Drew Stanton. He was very nice to me in my time out at Michigan State with you guys.
He's a nice kid, and he hates Michigan.
If you stay
nice, admirable qualities.
If you stay nice to him, maybe at some point down the road, he can get you tickets to that arena football game. You're a big Chicago Rush fan.
That's right. You don't have to be a good college quarterback to make it to the next level. Just tune into the Patriots game this weekend.
I've got no comment. I have to be completely objective about throwing the Patriots from here on out.
Why?
As I always have been. Very objective about the New England Patriots.
You have a man crush on Tom Brady.
That's an unfair comment.
Why is it unfair? It's accurate.
You have a man crush on Brady Quinn.
No, I don't. I like Quinn, but I'm not infatuated with him like you are with Brady.
Hey, you know what? The guy's won 3 Super Bowls. He's got a nice resume. And he's dating Giselle.
It's a cover-up. Derek Jeter told me so.
Derek Jeter's taken. He's got his third baseman buddy over there.
Finally, we get the Boston kid to open up a little bit.
Bring up
Derek
Yankees.
Jeter.
Oh, my. What are we talking about, Hobey?
Rook, can you write a 150-word essay for us on the similarities between Tom Brady and Derek Jeter?
I don't swear.
They're actually
like
very
that.
Similar when you look at their careers.
Don't swear like that.
They've happened to be okay players on excellent teams at the right time. And they've gotten way more credit than they deserve.
It's so far off base.
Kind of that's what it seems like.
Tom Brady plays at the most important position in football. Derek Jeter plays shortstop, and he's not even that good at it. If he didn't run towards the catcher and flail his arm to cut off a poorly thrown ball from the right fielder against Oakland,
Don't get me started on that play. I think that's ridiculous. I think that's 4 bad plays, and then people call it one of the great plays in baseball history.
Well, you can render the Boston guy speechless, you know you've hit the right topic.
He's just a...
Yeah. Why don't you tell me...
Okay, no, tell me, if Tom Brady's so important, how do you turn the ball over 4 times and win?
Hey, did he win?
No, the kicker won, like always. It's been important Brady's career.
You know what? Why don't you go make fun of Larry Bird now? All right, you know, insult Bobby Orr while I'm down.
I won't do that. Those guys were good players.
I think you're a little misguided about Brady. I think that, and actually,
he throws like a girl. Oh no, sorry.
I have to follow the progress of the Minnesota Timberwolves, so I can go off on Kevin McHale plenty if you're interested.
Yeah, he's not very good in that job.
Hey, tell Kevin McHale to call up his good friend Danny Ainge and, you know, sell him Kevin Garnett for, you know, on the cheap.
No.
NBA talk on this podcast is something I can't tolerate. Pro wrestling, no problem.
I was going to say,
the NBA thing, we're getting out of this right now.
I was going to say, Mikhail.
We could talk pro wrestling and The Simpsons and just about anything, but we would delve into the NBA. Glad
no,
he shut her down.
Putting a stop to this.
No, I have one final comment. Mikhail is a terrible GM, but he was good with the Celtics, and he was fantastic on Cheers.
That's true.
Right. I'll give you a pass on that, boss, because the comment was about Cheers, not about
more about Cheers than it was about his basketball career.
Yes. Yes. Anything else, boys?
I don't think so.
All right. No podcast deterioration again. Very little, I should say.
Tom Brady for Hobie.
Tom Brady for Holder. And you know what? Just, you know what?
Just
the guy is such a bozo. The most important play of that game on Sunday, they didn't even let him touch the ball. I mean, that just goes to show you what they think of their quarterback.
Oh, please. That was a perfectly executed play.
Yes, because Tom Brady was not involved in it.
He was a decoy.
No, it's hard for him to handle. It's hard for him to handle shotgun snaps because he's got all those Super Bowl rings on his fingers.
And his batting gloves.
Just
his batting
very
gloves.
Well put. Very well.
Well, I'm just saying. You know, I'm a Minnesota Vikings fan. I'd kill to have a bad quarterback with three Super Bowl rings.
I think Vinatieri will prove once and for all that he was the key to those Patriots Super Bowls. This Sunday or Saturday, whenever they play. The NFL
is going
to
but you can't kick field goals from the other team's 20.
Vinatieri can. And
hey,
he will.
You know what? Read my column in the bottom metro on Friday. You'll learn all about Minnetary.
Uh-oh.
Oh, boy.
Okay.
At least he's... Who was the Vikings quarterback at the end of the year?
Ryan Lomwell.
No.
Oh, no. That was the beginning of the year.
Tavares Jackson.
Yeah, what's that guy?
He's at Alabama State.
I would rather
he's a poor man. He's a poor man's Spurgeon Wynn.
He's like Michael Bishop without the exchange rate.
Oh, wow.
No, there's
purple pride.
Purple quarterback.
He's Brad Pink.
Argos. Legendary Argos quarterback.
Brad Banks is a name. Not to be confused with Tony Banks.
Speaking of horrible...
Tony Banks beat the Wolverines. Tony Banks had a lot more starts in the NFL than Ron Paulus and Drew Henson. All right, with that.
Hey, watch out for the career of Chad Henne.
I will watch out for it. We're done podcasting. Plus, don't hit the hang up button. Hit the stop button. And thank you for reading Inside College Hockey.
Was this also the Inside College Football podcast?
No. Inside Overrated Quarterbacks podcast.
Stanton on line one.
Glad he's kind of like Jason here. You think you've killed him, but he keeps rising up.
Just kill it.